Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to our next episode here at the Diplomatic History Channel at New Books Network. I'm your host, Grant Golub. I'm a PhD candidate in the Department of International History at the London School of Economics. On today's episode, I have with me Dr. Joseph Steeve, who's the author of the amazing new book, The Regime Change Consensus, Iraq in American Politics, 1990-2003. Dr. Steeve is a postdoctoral researcher at the Ohio State University's Mershon Center for International Security Studies. His articles and essays can be found in the International History Review, The Washington Post, War on the Rocks, ARC Digital, and the Rally News Observer. His book, The Regime Change Consensus, which we'll be discussing today, was just published with Cambridge University Press in July 2021, and we're really excited to have him here today. So, Joe, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Grant. I'm really happy to be talking to you today.
So, Joe, I think we should start by the conversation by telling our listeners, what's this book all about? What are sort of the main arguments that you're trying to make in this book?
So I think the core of this book is trying to explain not just how the Bush administration came to support regime change and ultimately the invasion of Iraq. There's plenty of really great scholarship on that. I particularly recommend Mike Mazar's book, Leap of Faith.
Okay.
It was to explain how the broader political, you know, intellectual and media establishment in the United States came to the position of, or the positions of, A, thinking that containment was inadequate to dealing with the Iraqi threat, and then B, seeing regime change and democratization as the only solution. So, you know, the book is a way to kind of tell that story. I think that's significant because, so, you know, you have this group of neoconservatives and other Iraq hawks in the Bush administration. They say immediately after 9/11 that Iraq should be the centerpiece of our response. But then they have to go convince the rest of the country. They have to go convince Congress, the media, much of the public.
Right.
And so I was thinking about how can we trace historically the views of those, you know, power centers, I guess you could say, right? Those other we'll just call them power centers for now, that were so vital to getting most of the country on board with regime change in Iraq. And so, I think as scholars, we focused heavily on the regime change side of it.
Right.
How did, you know, the Bush administration come to this position? We also have to understand how they came to believe that containment was inadequate, that being the main alternative. So it's kind of a dual track story that tells the policy history of containment, but also the political debates about containment versus regime change from right before Desert Storm up to 2003. So I can go more into it, obviously, but that's the basic narrative.
And we'll definitely want to go into it more and really sort of and hash this out, because this is a story I think that a lot of people are not going to be familiar with. People are obviously know a lot about the 1991 Gulf War. But then all of a sudden we're back at Iraq in 2003. Obviously, there's the whole lead up, between 9/11 and the March 2003 invasion. But there's that whole period in the 1990s where especially younger generations who might have been born in the 1990s or born after 9/11 don't really know this story. So we're definitely going to want to unpack that. But before we get to that, I was wondering if you could tell our listeners what sort of motivated you to write about this as your first book? You know, what was the puzzle here, I suppose, I'm asking, that got you really interested in this topic?
Well, the original puzzle was kind of why containment, which to me had always seemed like a strategy that had essentially worked. That, you know, especially because after 2003, you found out that Saddam Hussein did not have this massive WMD arsenal.
Right.
His military remained weak. The economy was crippled. You can definitely debate the morality of the containment policy. But as a policy, it certainly kept Iraq very weak. Right. And we pursued regime change in this disastrous war. And so it seemed appropriate that we want to go back and ask, well, why did so many people abandon this containment policy or start to see it as a failure even before September 11th? So I thought that was a really interesting puzzle. I thought that a lot of the, you know, post-invasion debate about Iraq was really more about trying to get rid of one's sense of culpability for the war, not so much to understand what had actually happened in the preceding decade to the invasion. But actually, you know, came to this topic because of my high school teaching. So I used to be a high school teacher in Western Massachusetts. And I was lucky enough to be able to teach this class that, you know, basically they said, we need an elective for seniors. You can teach whatever you want. So I taught a class about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And in looking for things to assign to my students, you know, I never really found anything about the containment policy that I really, really liked. And I thought explained the whole story of it and explained why really after September 11th, most people who are involved in the Iraq debate just kind of said, well, everyone knows that containment has failed, right?
Right.
I thought that was a question that was worth interrogating more. And I didn't really have a good answer from my students when they asked the same question. So I guess I came to it through those two avenues.
So kind of zooming out a little bit, can you tell our listeners what sort of U.S.-Iraqi relations were, you know, sort of in brief, because obviously there's a really long history here, were sort of in the years leading up to Operation Desert Storm and the 1991 Gulf War? I mean, what sort of triggered that war? What were U.S.-Iraqi relations like? And why did President George H.W. Bush decide to get involved in the Middle East?
So U.S.-Iraqi relations had been mixed, very mixed in Iraqi. You know, since the Ba'ath Party took over in the 1960s, Iraq had aligned itself with the Soviet Union, and so was seen as a rival to the U.S. To U.S. allies in the Middle East, like Iran, Pakistan, or, you know, the Greater Middle East. So Iran and Pakistan, the Central Pact kind of countries. That started to change with the Iran-Iraq War, right? When Saddam Hussein invaded Iran and got in 1980, got involved in this interminable war. You know, the United States was most concerned with containing Iranian expansion and Islamist extremism in the region. So we started to kind of tilt towards Iraq, took them off the terrorist state sponsor list. We started to be more friendly towards economic aid and military sales to Iraq. And of course, you know, we had no problem with our allies like France selling tons and tons of military supplies to Iraq.
Right.
After 1988, when the war ends, the Bush administration thought, well, we've kind of reached out to Iraq. We've have a, you know, a potential relationship here. It's a very potentially wealthy state. It's going to be a power broker in the region. And so they designed a policy called engagement. And the hope here was that the United States could use economic aid, mostly through the Export-Import Bank and through this thing called the Commodity Credit Corporation, to kind of entice Iraq to become more like Egypt, to become a more compliant pro-U.S. ally instead of a more disruptive state in the region.
Right.
This policy also controversially involved not paying much attention or not speaking out against Iraqi atrocities, such as the Anfal campaign against the Kurds. It was contested domestically. You know, Claiborne Pell, senators as various as Claiborne Pell on the left and Jesse Helms on the right spoke out against this policy because of the kind of tolerance of Iraqi human rights abuses. It very quickly started to fall apart in 1989 and 1990 when Saddam made these threats to his neighbors. And, you know, the invasion of Kuwait in July of 1990 was the death knell of this policy. So that's the background. If you want, we can also talk about the larger, story of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, but that's the Iraq-specific background.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, let's talk about that. I mean, where does sort of Iraq in the years before Saddam decides to invade Kuwait, where does that fit into sort of larger or broader U.S. geostrategic thinking about the Middle East?
Yeah. So if you go back to the, the 60s and 70s, really 50s forward, right, U.S. goals in the Middle East are keep the Soviet Union out,
right,
defend Israel, and retain access to oil resources.
Right.
And over time, the prioritization of those goals shifts. And so as the Cold War wound down in the 1980s, there started to be less prioritization of keeping the Soviets out and more focus on oil resources. Whenever a U.S. politician used the word stability in the Middle East, that's in large part what they were referring to. It also had to do with Israel, but mainly with the flow of oil resources. And going back to the Carter Doctrine in 1979 or 80, I can't remember exactly when he gave that speech, the U.S. had said, we are going to stop any effort by an outside power to take control of the Persian Gulf's resources, right? Its oil resources.
Right.
At the time, we were thinking about the Soviet Union because they had just invaded Afghanistan. During the 1980s, we shifted to thinking about internal threats, right? Like Iran and then later on Iraq. So that was kind of the big picture setup, right? Our goal was to maintain right. This balance of power in the Middle East, that there was no single hegemon or internal hegemonic power that could control all of the oil resources or a preponderance of those oil resources in the region. When Iraq invaded Kuwait, it was essentially making a bid to do that, right? By seizing Kuwait's oil resources and then also being able to threaten and kind of menace Saudi Arabia. It could possibly control, basically have its hands around the windpipe of the global economy. So that's the big picture background right there. It's sort of the application of a policy designed for the Soviets to Iraq, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So Saddam invades Kuwait in the summer of 1990. What is the initial Bush administration reaction to this? And what do they then try and move to do to reverse the invasion?
Well, they're surprised and they're outraged. I mean, it's such an, in many ways, kind of an old school, one state invading another,
right,
just directly and blatantly violating their sovereignty, violating international law. So they're obviously outraged by it. Bush especially interprets it through his experiences of World War II and the kind
right.
of perceived lesson of needing to stand up to bullies early before they move on to even bigger things.
Right.
And they also see it as part of the post-Cold War world, right? They see it as this potentially defining moment.
Right.
If the international community can rally to defend the sovereignty of a member state, as well as the rights of the people within that state, then they can set kind of a new norm, right, of collective security for the post-Cold War system that they hope will be a more stable world. Right? And this is especially important because the Soviet Union is no longer going to step in and prevent the United States from intervening as they might have during the Cold War.
Right.
So they're definitely shocked, they're definitely outraged, and they move very quickly and, very effectively to mobilize the international community, as well as to put U.S. troops as part of Desert Shield into the region to block a move against Saudi Arabia. My personal opinion is that it was some of the most brilliant diplomacy of the 20th century in the United States, as quickly as they mobilized the international community. That's just my personal.
Yeah. So they're mobilizing the international community to try and isolate Saddam, politically, diplomatically, mm-hmm. economically. But as successful as those efforts might have been in terms of rallying a coalition, they ultimately don't deter Saddam from reversing his invasion. I mean, they obviously put U.S. troops into Saudi Arabia, as you mentioned, as part of Operation mm-hmm. Desert Shield. That prevents convinces Saddam not to sort of expand the invasion into Saudi Arabia. But ultimately, it doesn't convince him to pull back Iraqi forces from Kuwait. Can you maybe tell our listeners why he decides or why he's not sort of cowed into reversing himself after this?
It's a really great question. I'll call that compellence.
Okay.
We failed to compel him. You know, deterrence is preventing someone from acting. Compellence is trying to get them to act. Yeah, the failure of compellence is really interesting. You know, I think when you look at the, I'm not a scholar of Saddam Hussein, I know, or of Iraqi politics specifically.
Right.
When you look at the literature that's out there, especially David Palki's excellent work on Saddam, it seems that he expected there to be a showdown with the United States at some point in his lifetime for control of the Middle East.
Okay.
Kind of like Osama bin Laden, he had also come to believe that the United States was a bit of a paper tiger, that it might run away or be cowed if it suffered a certain number of battle casualties.
Right. You know,
that was kind of wishful thinking based on the Vietnam War, based on the withdrawal from Lebanon. But we also know that Saddam made his decisions in a very small bubble of people who were, you know, kind of pure sycophants and,
right,
you know, didn't always listen to, or almost never listen to dissenters, right? So I think there was always this tension between the rational Saddam and the irrational Saddam.
Right.
So obviously it was a huge blunder for him to not remove himself from Kuwait. And in fact, the Bush administration, there's some really interesting internal documents at the Bush Library that show they really didn't want him to leave, because if he left, he is, okay, right. So this is fascinating. If he had just withdrawn his forces in, let's say, December of 1990, well, then he gets away with this crime,
right?
This international crime. He gets to keep his military, which was considerable at the time,
right,
one of the, I think, 10 biggest in the world at the time. And what's to prevent him from doing something else, right? For doing it again.
Right.
So they really wanted him to stay and be punished in some sense so that he'd be easier to deal with afterwards. Okay. And I think that's, I'm not sure if I'm the first one to write about that, but that's something I write about in the book.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that at all. I mean, that's, yeah, I think Iraq had like the fourth largest military in the world at this time. You know, after the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and I don't remember who was third, but perhaps China, but
probably.
But yeah, I mean, they had this massive military. I mean, that is absolutely fascinating. So ultimately, Saddam doesn't leave Kuwait, and American efforts to compel him to leave fail. And so, what ultimately drives Bush and his advisors to greenlight an invasion from Saudi Arabia into Kuwait to try and roll back Saddam's forces?
Well, some of the things I've kind of already mentioned, right? They see it as really important to establishing these rules for the post-war international system.
Right.
The United States obviously has this idea of, you know, wanting to maintain the free flow of oil from the Middle East as a key part of upholding the global economy. In a more narrow sense, I think he comes to be kind of personally outraged by this. You know, Richard Haass put it really well. He says that George Bush Senior, or George H.W. Bush, was someone who really believed in the right way of doing things,
okay,
as in sort of decorum and kind of maybe what we might now call old-fashioned values. Like, you know, Richard Haass says, one time I showed up without a tie, you know, and he kind of got mad and said, yeah, go put a tie on. This is the White House.
Right.
And this may seem unconnected, but the way that Haass explains it is really interesting. He says that, you know, Bush would be willing, you know, if, for example, if Kuwait was doing things like slant drilling or exceeding its quota, right, these kind of little tricks in games, Iraq might have had a real case to come forward to the international community and say, look, or at least to OPEC, and say, Kuwait is cheating us, right?
Right.
But by just seizing Kuwait, by invading Kuwait, he so clearly violated any sense of process, right, of the right way of doing things. And so that seems to be a core value of his. And when you combine that with his experience of World War II and the lessons that the vast majority of Americans took away from that about appeasement, you get someone who was really willing to stake his political career on it. And he even says in his memoir that even if the congressional vote had gone against me, which it was actually pretty close, but even if,
yeah,
it had gone against me, I still would have pursued this just using my executive power because I thought it was that important.
Okay. Wow. So clearly, you know, this is very high stakes for Bush. And
yes,
right, he ultimately greenlights the invasion, and it's a massive success. You know, the war lasts like 100, you know, hours, something like that. Iraqi forces are quickly routed out of Kuwait. And, you know, Bush is a hero. His approval ratings go through the roof. I think right in the immediate aftermath of Desert Storm, he's at a 90% approval rating. It was like one of the highest of any American president in the modern era. And then he has a decision to make, right, about whether he's going to continue into Iraq and depose Saddam, or if he's just going to, you know, basically accept the gains that the United States has made or the reversals that they've given to Saddam and sort of halt the fighting. So, right, we know that Bush does not decide to go into Iraq and try and depose Saddam. Can you tell our listeners why he ultimately decides not to do that against the advice of a lot of his advisors, notably including his son, George W. Bush?
Yes. So I think the only person inside the Bush administration who was pushing to kind of go all the way to Baghdad was Paul Wolfowitz, which kind of tracks, right, with his later career. He had a number of reasons. I mean, the first was that the UN mandate and the congressional mandate were not for a regime change. They were for the defense of state sovereignty, right? The defense of, or the ejection of Iraq from Kuwait. That was a major factor. So he knew that this coalition would simply collapse if he actually, you know, moved into Iraq, or U.S. forces were in Iraq, but if he actually attempted to overthrow the regime. He and Scowcroft and Defense Secretary Cheney all believed that the United States would get bogged down in some kind of desert Vietnam. They thought there might be guerrilla fighting, that they would then be involved in occupying this country that none of them really understood. You know, Colin Powell was particularly hesitant to do this, right? You know, Powell believed that the military should be strictly used for kind of pure military operations, not for anything resembling nation building. So he was totally averse to this. I think they basically believed that this would turn to quagmire, that it would alienate the international community. It would also collapse the political coalition behind the war. Right.
You
know, most people who signed on to support this war, at least in Congress, didn't think it meant regime change.
Right.
And so there was just no basis for it, you know, under the law, no basis for it in strategy. And so he decided against it. But really, that was a decision they made in the fall. If you look at some of the planning documents, there was no discussion at any point or no sense at any point that they would seriously consider finishing Saddam off.
Okay. All right. So that's very interesting then. So ultimately, they decide not to sort of continue rolling on to Baghdad. And so in sort of the aftermath of the war, what is American policy towards Iraq, and what is Bush administration thinking in its final 2 years in office about how to prevent Iraq from perhaps launching another invasion, either of Kuwait or maybe some other Middle Eastern neighbors? Basically, how are they now trying to move towards containing Iraq now that Iraq has been pushed out of Kuwait?
That's a great question. So they set up the tools of containment and the strategy of containment during Desert Storm. So they know that if they're not going to overthrow Saddam, they kind of hope that he might fall from power, but they don't really know if that's going to happen. I think they expected that to happen. It became clear by the spring that it wasn't going to happen. So even before, you know, regardless of who ends up on top of the heap in Iraq after the dust has settled, whether it's Saddam or some general or whoever, the plan was some kind of, or the plan was basically to impose sanctions on Iraq and then use those sanctions as a bludgeon to get them to agree to weapons inspections.
Okay.
Right. And that was that's essentially the core mechanism of containment. Sanction them so that they will comply with WMD inspections. One critical part of this is that during Desert, or shortly after Desert Storm, we found out that the Iraqis were way further ahead in their nuclear programs than we had thought before.
Right.
Before. That they were maybe within a year of actually getting access to a nuclear weapon. That made us much more desirous of performing those weapons inspections. I think what gets tricky is the question of what exactly can Saddam do to comply and to become a quote-unquote normal country again.
right.
To have the sanctions off of him, to have the U.S. military not breathing down his back. You know, Richard Haass and Richard Clark, some of the people who were strategizing about this, writing strategy papers on the NSC during Desert Shield and Desert Storm, were saying, well, the simple mechanism is if he complies, you lift the inspections, right?
Okay.
But the problem with that, in my opinion, was the political side of it.
Right.
That Bush had played up Saddam as a new Hitler, that Saddam Hussein in many ways was truly horrendous, right? I mean,
right.
You know, things like launching missiles at Israel and to try to bring them into the war, you know,
right.
His generally totalitarian apparatus of government, destroying the oil wells in Kuwait to create this environmental good. I mean, you know, it's kind of a villainous character.
Right.
And this argument started to be generated during Desert Shield and Desert Storm that this was a totalitarian regime, and the only way you could make Iraq a normal, stable country in the region was to overthrow the regime and replace it with a democracy. That even if it's a follower of Saddam Hussein who takes power, he's still going to be a product of that totalitarian mindset, right? That's
right.
Absolutely opposed to U.S. power, that's maniacally fixated on getting WMD and ultimately on dominating the region. And so Bush and, that becomes kind of the political expectation. And in American, I call this the fallout from
right.
victory. A lot of Americans are really disappointed by the way the war ends. There seem to be all these little points that the United States could have pushed a little harder, gone a little deeper into Iraq, targeted the Iraqi Republican Guard, and maybe that would have toppled the regime, right? So there's this mismatch between the ends of Bush's strategy, the rhetoric that Bush used and the political heat around the war and the way it actually ends.
Right.
And you have to add on to that the refugee crisis, right? The massacre of the civilian, the Shia in the south, right? Iraq almost plunges into a civil war. The United States intervenes in Operation Provide Comfort to protect Kurdish refugees in the north.
Right.
It's this just messy, sticky, ambiguous ending. And so Bush makes these statements, and other Bush officials make these statements at the end of the war that say, well, we're not going to lift sanctions while Saddam is in power. Right. And
right.
that totally goes against the way the UN Security Council resolutions that created the sanctions is written, because those say, if you obey the inspections, sanctions will be lifted.
Right.
And that creates this divide between the United States and the rest of the international community in how to enforce the sanctions and inspections. And so I really think that the really 6 months after the end of Desert Storm are almost as important to Iraqi-U.S. relations for that decade as Desert Storm is itself. And that's something I try to explore in the book.
Right.
Sorry, that was a long answer, but
no, I mean that those are the best kinds of answers, ones that are really full of the detail and really get into it. I mean, thank you. So, looking at the other side of this in the aftermath of the Gulf War and Desert Storm, what is Saddam's reaction to all this? I mean, a lot of times when we're talking about international politics and relations, especially with a country like the United States, it's like the U.S. does X. And, the why, which is sort of the objective of X, that just happens, right? But other countries are actors who have agency in the international system. So Saddam has now been defeated, and he can see that the U.S. and perhaps its partners are now trying to sort of contain it. And what is he trying to do to perhaps undermine containment? Or generally, what would you say his reaction is to American policy post the Gulf crisis?
So in a sense, and I'm drawing on the work of other scholars here, I'm not an Iraqi specialist, but Saddam sort of has a confirmation bias with Desert Storm. You know, he thought the United States was a potentially paper tiger before the war. And even
right.
though his military gets smashed during the war, it's such a decisive, seemingly decisive conflict. He, at the end of the conflict, thinks, this shows America won't go all the way, right? They don't have the metal or the toughness to really finish me off, even
right.
though they completely crippled this military and destroyed much of Iraqi infrastructure as well. So in a sense, he's sort of reconfirmed in his delusions by the outcome of the war. And he very quickly sets about creating a coordinated early, he kind of tells Tariq Aziz to start creating this coordinated strategy for obstructing and resisting the inspectors. And he hopes that the international community besides America and Britain will become tired of this, right? All the obstructions, the harassment, et cetera, and that they'll just want to return to normal trade relations with Iraq. And also that they might be fearful of American power in the post-Cold War world. And eventually this will allow them to come back into the family of normal nations here. So that's his basic strategy for most of the post-Desert Storm conflict. There are a few details, I don't write a ton about Saddam specifically in the book. There are a few details that change in the 90s, but that essentially remains his outlook. Although on the flip side, I don't want to mask how successful the inspections actually were, because the inspections, they dismantle his nuclear program very successfully. They find a huge biological weapons program, although it takes a while, and they destroy catalog most of that. And they destroy and seal a huge chemical weapons program. And so in spite of Iraqi non-compliance, the inspections were remarkably, this is sort of my opinion, the inspections were remarkably successful. What the American political conversation focused on was the obstruction, not what they actually found and destroyed.
Right. So shifting ahead a little bit now, to the Clinton administration, right? George H.W. Bush is defeated for re-election in 1992. The only two presidents before that had happened as well. But anyway, he's defeated for re-election. Bill Clinton comes into office in 1993. And what is sort of early Clinton administration thinking about Iraq? I mean, was Saddam on Clinton's radar? Was this something that he ignored at first? What was his policy towards Iraq? And also, what was his administration's thinking about the Middle East now as well?
Yeah, so Clinton's policy is essentially the same, I argue. He's dealing with, first of all, a domestic political focus. And second of all, all these foreign policy crises erupt during his tenure that take his attention away from Iraq. And throughout much of the decade, Iraq appears to be, not exploding imminently. So, it's not a huge focus in the 1990s. And so he's willing to kind of go along with the political consensus that will keep the pressure on Saddam more or less indefinitely, even if he complies with the inspections. He's a little more concerned, I think, than Bush with the international community. He knows the international community is not down with the way America is conducting containment, especially this commitment to sanctions forever. And he knows that over the course of the 90s, the Iraqi health crisis is an increasing tragedy and obstacle to being able to keep the pressure on Iraq. By 95, it's become really, really, really bad there.
Right.
And so he tries to signal signal toughness to the American political scene while signaling flexibility to the international scene. And what he basically says is, if Saddam Hussein were to fully comply with inspections, as well as all these other requirements that come in some later Security Council resolutions, like even things like respecting human rights in Iraq, which is not going to happen under the Ba'athist regime. Then we will consider removing the sanctions. But that's not going to happen. So it's really a moot conversation. And that's kind of Clinton's way of navigating between the domestic and the international demands. And for the rest of the decade, his policy is basically if Iraq threatens its neighbors, we rush forces to the region and we issue threats, right? And at some points, we actually bomb Iraq like Desert Fox to try to keep him down. We keep supporting the inspections. But at no point was he ever, I think at no point was he super willing to expend a lot of political capital in actually changing Iraq's strategy or challenging that consensus about regime change.
So in the early, I guess throughout most of the Clinton years, after the Gulf War starts to recede from view, I mean, what is Iraq's place in American politics? Does Iraq itself recede from view as being sort of a hot button issue that's being debated between the parties? Or is this something that still really is front and center in American politics, despite all these other things swirling about in the 1990s?
It's a really important question. And I get this a lot, and this question a lot in various talks that I've done. And I think the issue here is the difference between the salience of an issue and the spectrum of thought about an issue. So I wouldn't say that Iraq is a super salient political issue in the 90s. It is in 1997 and 1998 in the lead up to Desert Fox, when you have this series of inspections crises, you have a rising neoconservative movement, and really, you know, you can add most of the Democrats and most of the Republicans to this, that push Clinton to try to be tougher on Iraq. And that leads to the Iraq Liberation Act. Right, that's the only time in the 90s I would say that Iraq becomes a super salient political issue.
Right.
But I think that the way Americans thought about Iraq is still being shaped in important ways, even though it's not on the front pages of the New York Times or on, you know, dominating CNN. So let me give an example of this. Right. Every time the inspectors find something big in Iraq, especially if they find something big that it was very clear the Iraqis were trying to hide, like they do with this trove of biological weapons documents in 1995 that was revealed by Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, Hussein Kamel. The American political spectrum, and, you know, most commentators, and I'm not just including neoconservatives here, included a lot of liberals, included a lot of Democrats, moderates, say, well, this isn't a crisis worth going to war over, but it shows us that Saddam is never, ever going to comply with these inspections, that every time we think we're done with the inspections, we find something else, either a way that he's trying to hoodwink us or something that he's hidden that he could use to revive his programs after he's gone. But the important thing is his intentions are not changing.
Right.
And that becomes a lesson that even though Iraq is not a super salient political issue, it's becoming more deeply ingrained as a common sense point. So when you reach a crisis with Iraq, that's the pre-existing common sense. And that happens in a whole bunch of ways with different issues regarding Iraq, different ways of looking at Iraq in the 1990s. I think that's one of the more unique aspects of my book is not so much focusing on, you know, did Iraq dominate the headlines in the 90s?
Right.
But how did people think about Iraq in the 90s? How did that change? And how did that shape later decision-making?
Right. So, you know, so moving into the second part of the 1990s, right, after the after Clinton's reelected, how does thinking, I mean, you sort of are alluding to this right in your previous answer, but how does thinking about Iraq change? Essentially, you have the Iraq Liberation Act of 1998, which Clinton signs and basically says that, or it says explicitly, official American policy is the removal of Saddam Hussein from Iraq. What leads to this, from sort of moving from this containment policy, which, as you said, has been generally successful in constraining Saddam's broader regional ambitions? How does that American political thinking shift from containment towards explicitly endorsing regime change?
Really, really great question. So I see it as a pretty gradual shift over the course of the 1990s, but by the end, pretty decisive. I think you see a bunch of things coming together there. One is that frustration with Saddam's continued obstruction, right, of the inspectors, as well as his continued human rights abuses. That's definitely a factor.
Right.
Another factor is that the United States, or at least many Americans, politicians, policymakers, strategists, see the United States as the unipolar power. You know, containment for them was not something a unipolar power should have to do. If Saddam is a, you know, mid-level regional power, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to achieve regime change there.
Right.
In the 90s, there's another discourse about democracy, in which democracy comes to be seen as kind of the default, the universal default of societies. And so there's this, I think, somewhat naive hope in the 90s, again, not just on the right, but across the political spectrum, that if you remove Saddam Hussein's regime, well, democracy is the natural thing that will flow from that. So why not pursue regime change there?
Right.
There's also a key shift in the mid-1990s. It's not really about ideas, but it's about the situation on the ground in Iraq. In 1995 and 1996, Saddam Hussein crushes these first of all, he crushes a major coup attempt that the United States was sponsoring. And he also crushes the part of the Kurdish opposition in the north that was allied with the Iraqi National Congress. The Iraqi National Congress was the main Iraqi exile group that was very politically influential in the United States. It had a presence in Kurdistan up until 1996 when it was crushed in a pretty hackneyed attempt at overthrowing the regime by the Kurds and by the Iraqi National Congress. Now, part of the reason why containment was able to maintain some political legitimacy in the 90s was this hope that it will be solved by the quote-unquote silver bullet solution, that at some point you keep the pressure on and some general is going to off Saddam Hussein. Right. And then we'll have a more, still have a nasty guy in power, but he'll be compliant with the United States. He won't be this sort of psycho like Saddam.
Right.
And so once Saddam crushes the internal opposition, now it seems like he's pretty much safe. Like he's going to be in power indefinitely. He's only about in his late 50s at that point. So he's got a good 20 years left. That's not like an immediate crisis, but it affects the way Americans think about it. And they, by 1997, 1998, when we get to the Iraq Liberation Act, a lot of American politicians and intellectuals are arguing there's no other way out with Iraq. It's either Saddam forever or regime change. And that's one of the things that pushes the spectrum away from containment and to regime change.
And so sort of following on from that, I mean, why do so many people, American elites, people operating in Washington, why are they so concerned about Saddam and Iraq, years after the Gulf crisis? Is it because they're concerned about potential, WMD program? Do they think that he actually poses a major threat to the stability of the Middle East? I mean, why is there this continued obsession, for lack of a better term, with Saddam and Iraq really throughout this period?
So I think at the core of it, I think there's maybe two things I can say to that. One is the broader mood of the post-Cold War world, with all of this, I would say, very real progress towards democratization in the world. He's a major holdout, right? He's a, I can't think of the right metaphor, but he's sore thumb. He's sticking his thumb out, whatever digital metaphor you want to use. He's defying the United States at a time where its power seems unchallengeable and the course of history seems to be going in its direction. I think that's an underlying factor. But probably the bigger reason is that it is Americans thinking, well, what would have happened if Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons before Desert Storm?
Right.
Well, there probably wouldn't have been a Desert Storm. Right. He probably would have been able to get away with at least the seizure of Kuwait, and would fundamentally change the strategic landscape of the Middle East and probably start a rush to achieve nuclear weapons by many countries in that region. And, what could possibly make that region worse? A nuclear arms race. And so I think that's essentially the same logic as the Gulf War. But the big change that starts to happen over the course of the 1990s is you bring terrorism to that.
Right.
If Saddam is... You bring two more things in. You bring in terrorism, and you bring in this discourse about revenge, especially in neoconservative circles and the influence of these quote-unquote scholars like Laurie Malroy. You start to get the argument that Saddam Hussein is fixated on revenge and that he's using terrorists to get it. Right? And that's the precursor to the Bush administration's nexus argument, in which Saddam Hussein, this threat of rogue states giving WMD to terrorists, that's an uncontainable threat, an undeterrable threat, and an intolerable one after 9/11. So that's my answer to that.
So George W. Bush gets elected president in 2000, hotly contested election, but he becomes president in January 2001. And like we were just saying, it is official American policy now since 1998, October 1998, if I remember correctly, to remove Saddam from Iraq. So we do already have the foundations for this. Mm-hmm. But what is Bush, and I mean Bush specifically, what is his personal thinking about Iraq and its place in the Middle East. I mean, does he have early conceptions about Iraq? Is he concerned about it? I mean, when he comes into the White House in January 2001, what is his personal thinking about this issue?
It doesn't seem like he had a super strong opinion on Iraq. Yeah, I think okay. He was also intending to be a more domestically focused president.
Right.
And his original foreign policy vision was shaped much more by great power concerns. So I think, you know, the administration does a few reviews of Iraq, but, you know, there's this document from like September 6th or something, September 6th, 2011, something around that first week of September, where Donald Rumsfeld says, we really need to get a policy on this country.
Right.
Right. I mean, you have people in the White House who are very strongly pro-regime change, but they're kind of balanced out by Powell and by the more realist elements. And Bush just doesn't seem like he was pushing on it. And so that I imagine that would have been the trajectory of Iraq policy had there been no September 11th.
So how does 9/11 change? Well, actually, before I ask that, what are some of the other folks in the administration? I mean, you just mentioned there are some people who are very in favor of regime change. Who are those people? And then, I mean, you mentioned Powell, on the other hand, who's sort of has more restrained views. I mean, what are sort of the divides within the Bush administration, within his inner circle, or maybe not his inner circle necessarily, but sort of within his foreign policy circle? What are the divides on Iraq policy and thinking about Saddam's regime?
Important question. So the two hotbeds of pro-regime change, Iraq hawkery in the Bush administration are the vice president's office and much of his staff, people like John Hanna, and the Defense Department, right?
Okay.
Undersecretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld himself, and then a lot of just the staffers, civilian staffers in the Defense Department were neoconservatives who had been Iraq hawks since the Persian Gulf War. Those people also act as really important conduits for outside regime change advocates, you know, from neocons like Kagan and Crystal to historian Bernard Lewis and the scholar Fuad Ajami and Kanan Makia.
Right.
They kind of bring a outside intellectual firepower in favor of regime change into the administration. And then I think the way most scholars think about it is that pro-regime change element of the administration is balanced out by Powell and Rice at State and National Security Council, who generally don't appoint regime change advocates. I think the only limit to that way of looking at it is that I don't really see Powell and Rice as super committed to containment.
Okay.
Right? They don't really seem to ever make a case for containment. Although they say in their congressional testimonies in 2000 or 2001 when they're being appointed to those positions that they think containment is fine. It's not like they're playing the role of George Ball in the Vietnam War,
right,
who actually
right.
makes a case for not doing it,
right?
Or for more restraint. And I think it's a really important factor in thinking about why the war happens.
So the question that I was going to ask earlier then is sort of how does 9/11 change the whole calculus for Bush and his advisors? I mean, how does that transform their thinking about Iraq and transform the urgency or maybe create a sense of urgency for the U.S. to do something about Saddam and his regime?
Yeah, well, it's important to say that 9/11 requires interpretation, right?
Right.
Even in the moment, it required interpretation because it was not connected to Iraq. There were no
right.
Iraqis on the planes. Saddam Hussein was not involved, right? You know,
right.
mostly Saudi and Egyptian hijackers, and you know, Al Qaeda is this transnational organization with a
right.
Saudi at the head of it. And so, it's not so much that it just leads to this instant shift to Iraq. You know, even hardcore neocons, or very like relatively few of them say after 9/11, let's invade Iraq right now. A lot of them say we need to pay more attention to Iraq.
Okay.
But I think it's really inside the Bush administration that you get the combination of two things, right? The first is that we really have to do something. We have to shake up the Middle East, because the Middle East is just this political and extremist cesspool from which terrorism will continue to emanate, right? Al-Qaeda and other groups, until we find a way of dramatically transforming it, right? And so that leads to this desire for a more radical action, especially amongst the Iraq hawks in the region, that if we can take out a state rival like Iraq in the Middle East and implant a democracy there, we can start a long-term solution to terrorism. We can start undermining the conditions that create terrorism. There's also a desire, this is the importance of interpreting 9/11.
Right.
This is kind of my second book concept, and so I'll just go into it right now. Conservatives since the 60s have been interpreting terrorism as in large part a response to perceived American weakness and decadence.
Okay.
And that's something you can trace in conservative thought from kind of the rise of modern terrorism in the late 1960s. And that's how so many conservatives see 9/11, right? That Osama doesn't think we're going to really hit back. That he thinks that we're this paper tiger, that we're decadent, a collapsing civilization, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's a desire in much of the Bush administration for what they call a demonstration effect, that we're going to go out and smash somebody because we need to prove that we will smash people. Because that's the way to get other countries to stop messing with us and to stop sponsoring or harboring terrorists. Right?
Right.
And so, and then, of course, there's just a massive political opening, right? The American people are desperate for action to be taken. They're much more pliable and willing to support dramatic action.
Right.
And they're much more concerned with terrorism. So that nexus concept becomes legitimized. And so, you know, without going way too much into the details, eventually the Iraq hawks, using these ideas, are able to win over George Bush and start to push for an invasion of Iraq as the centerpiece of the global war on terror by about the spring of 2002. So that's, you know, I do think 9/11 is absolutely critical. It was an absolute precondition for the Iraq war. Not the only precondition, but absolute one. And I think that's the basic story, the basic ideas.
So is Iraq then, you know, because you talked about sort of the smashing effect, is that really what's driving a lot of this? Okay, so 9/11 happens, and we need to prove to transnational terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda that we cannot, or that the United States, rather, cannot be messed with. Mm-hmm. So is Iraq, because of the issues that the United States have already been having with Iraq for the past 10 years, is that part of the reason or a lot of the reason why Iraq is then chosen, even though there wasn't an actual connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein? I mean, the Iraq hawks and the administration must have known that, or they did know that. So, I mean, how were they able to, I mean, you talked about the nexus event being legitimized or the nexus concept, but how did they initially put those things together to then be able to sort of create that or sell that as a credible policy or way of thinking about this?
Well, I think that just, I want to change one thing about what I said earlier.
Okay.
The demonstration effect concept is aimed less at terrorist groups than it is aimed at state sponsors.
Okay.
Because terrorists, Al-Qaeda is not going to stop, right? Period. I mean, they're fanatically devoted. A more rational actor like Bashar al-Assad might change his behavior if he sees, or Libya is a great example, right? You know, the Iraq war may have prompted Libya to surrender its weapons its nuclear weapons program. That appears to be the demonstration effect in action, although it's more complicated than that.
Right.
And then on your question, I think that Iraq is not a country that's chosen just because the United States needed to smash something. You know, the actors who are involved in that switch or that transition to focusing on Iraq have been fixated on Iraq for a long time.
Right.
There was never an Iran Liberation Act or a North Korea Liberation Act.
Right.
Of course, with Iraq, you have this villainous leader who it's easy to rally people against, right? In contrast to Iran, which was under, I believe that was still Rafsanjani at the time, who was more of a reformer. You know, North Korea is not doable because that will possibly involve a war with China and possibly the destruction of South Korea. And then Iran is not just led by a more moderate leader, but is a massive, much larger society than Iraq. So Iraq does seem more doable. But then you also have to bring back in that revenge discourse, right?
Right.
You know, people like John Mearsheimer, you know, they argue before the Iraq war that, well, Saddam Hussein is essentially a rational actor and he's not going to throw away his regime and his survival by giving weapons of mass destruction to terrorists. Well, the neoconservative and the Iraq hawk answer to that is, well, we've seen him gamble and mess up before,
right?
Like in invading Kuwait. So maybe it's not necessarily about rationality, but just a tendency to gamble. But then he's also fixated on revenge, right? That he supported, Paul Wolfowitz, for example, had supported this book and even handed it out inside the Defense Department that said that Saddam Hussein was responsible for pretty much every major terrorist attack against the United States in the 1990s, starting with the World Trade Center attack in 1993. And so I think they really believed he was behind September 11th or involved in it. You know,
really?
They pushed that, the Prague story and other connections extremely hard inside and outside the administration. And so if you factor in this belief in Saddam Hussein's desire for revenge, all of a sudden the Nexus concept looks very possible.
Right.
And very threatening, because maybe he will actually do that. And then when, after 9/11, people's conception of what was possible had just totally changed.
Right.
And when you put yourself in that context, that emotional context, you start to see how you could build momentum for what now pretty much everyone agrees was a mistake.
Right.
Yeah.
So throughout 2002, I mean, the United States, I was 7 years old at the time, but I can still remember some of it quite well. I mean, I still remember 9/11 like it was yesterday, as I'm sure every American who had a memory at that point could. Throughout 2002, right, there's a very public debate, a public political conversation about Iraq, as the Bush administration is trying to build its case for a potential invasion or potentially to do something. Within the Bush administration, what does that process look like based on your research? I mean, how were Iraq hawks and Bush's national security team, how are they trying to build this case to do something about Saddam and actually potentially invade Iraq and possibly overthrow him?
Well, full disclosure about this book. This book does not, systematically explore the debate within the administration.
Okay.
Because other scholars have done that extremely well, especially Michael Mazar and the journalist Robert Draper. Hundreds of interviews that they've conducted.
Right.
So, but I think the funny thing within the administration is that there is no debate. Right?
Okay.
That doesn't seem to be a moment where the principal sat down and said, what are the pros and cons? What are the options here? And, they definitely debate how to do it, right? I mean, the Powell and Rice side of things says we need to go to the UN, need to build a coalition, et cetera, make this more legitimate. The Cheney and Rumsfeld side don't want to do that, right? They kind of want to just do it more unilaterally. But there's just not, when you compare it to something like Frederick Loggeval's Choosing War, you can see a real debate there, right?
Right.
Even amongst the more hawkish members of the administration, you see a little bit of agonizing in people like McNamara. I just don't think that occurred in the case of the Iraq War. Although when the full documentation can be seen, maybe we'll see that.
Right.
I think what's more important is, or at least important for the book that I wrote, is trying to understand the public debate. Because when the Bush administration starts pushing Iraq as the centerpiece of the war on terror, the majority of the pushback is tactical, right? From Democrats, okay, from more realist-leaning Republicans, from a lot of liberals, from a lot of the media. It's more, how do we do this the right way? As the title, the fifth chapter of the book is called The Right Way to Change a Regime, as opposed to a systematic effort to say, do we really need to pursue regime change in order to achieve our security goals or in order to fight terrorism. when you look at the people who said containment is adequate, still adequate for those goals, or that we should focus on renewing containment, like using kind of the post 9/11 political capital or international capital to restore containment, that's a very relatively small group of people. It's realists and it's sort of non-interventionist leaning Democrats who say that containment is working and we should keep doing it. But like mainstream Democrats, for example, your Joe Bidens, right, they never come forward and say containment is working.
Right.
That we should stick with it. Right? They say, they kind of ask the Bush administration, do you have enough troops? Let's go to the UN first. We need to try inspections again. Right. But to me, it's all very procedural. And the Bush administration really never had any intention of seeing the inspections through or, compromising with any other countries.
Right.
So I think that's the important way to think about the spectrum of debate. And really, if I could say one of the main contributions of this book, it would be explaining how that spectrum of debate came to be,
right,
going back to the Gulf War.
When you were writing this book and doing the research for it, what do you think some of the challenges were in writing about a topic that has been, in one way or another, sort of constantly talked about for nearly the last 20 years? I mean, what were some of the things that you thought you might anticipate in terms of challenges, and maybe what were some unexpected ones too in trying to sort of craft this narrative?
Yeah, well, probably the biggest challenge is that it's not like doing the history of something in World War I where we have access to all the documents that we want.
Right.
So the book is designed in a way that I think still makes contributions to scholarship without being a Frederick Loggeval type Choosing War book, which, of course, I love that book, but it's just not the book that can be written right now.
Right.
One of the other challenges was just the fact that Iraq is so, reshaped the way that Americans think about the war, the world.
Right.
And I think reshaped our politics too. Is that, for example, it's so tied to the debate between liberal internationalism and realism.
Right.
That I really wanted to avoid making the book about that.
Right.
Right. So you had to kind of step back, and like one of my advisors, Ben Waterhouse, he put it really well. He said, try to write this as if it was a book about the Philippine-American War, right?
Okay.
As if, for the most part, the continuing relevance of Iraq and the continuing debates about it, try to keep those a few steps removed from what you're actually doing, because you need to write a history book. It's not a policy book. It's not an advocacy book.
Right.
So that was something I had to keep in mind, because if I can be perfectly frank, I opposed the war as a 13-year-old. I remember my dad and his neighbor arguing about it, and I was late for school because they were arguing about it in the front yard. My dad was against it, so I kind of just followed his lead on that one.
Of course, yeah.
And I say first sentence of the book is I think it was the greatest blunder since Vietnam. So I also had to put those opinions aside a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
Just remembering as well, both my parents were adamantly opposed to the war as well. And I remember thinking about I was even younger than you. Like I said, I was seven in 2002. And when we actually invaded, I remember my parents just constantly talking about it, not only in front of me and just like shouting at the television, but also with everyone they knew, just that they were adamantly opposed to it. And most people that they knew were ambivalent about it. I remember thinking too, which was quite striking, especially sort of thinking about that now being an adult.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for my final question, if a policymaker or someone who, was thought about Iraq in American politics or sort of the future of Iraq for America's Middle East policy picked up your book, if you had to choose one thing for them to come away from reading your book, what do you think it should be?
I would say to think about the scale of American power in the world.
Okay.
And I don't necessarily put myself in the kind of the restraint crowd or category. But I think one of the sort of lessons here is that containment containment came to be seen as a conservative, not conservative like right-leaning, but conservative as in limited in goals.
Right.
Almost unambitious, static policy.
Right.
Compared to what Americans believe they could achieve in the post-9/11, post-Cold War, unipolar world.
Right.
My lesson is, if you look at containment, what we're actually trying to do, it was a phenomenally ambitious policy. Right. It involves supporting a decade of intrusive weapons inspections in a hostile country. It involved two no-fly zones over about a third of Iraqi territory that we maintained permanently from 1991 on. It involved sanctioning and almost cutting off completely a country from outside trade, right? One of the world's largest oil exporters. So, with all these neighbors, right? It involved a permanent U.S. military position in the Middle East.
Right.
It involves several instances of the United States striking Iraq with missiles or air power to try to get it to comply with the UN. So it was not a conservative, limited policy. It only was conservative and limited in the spectrum of what Americans thought was possible with their power in that decade. And so I think, for example, when I think about Syria, right, and I strongly supported Barack Obama's position and his restraint that he exercised in Syria, because I think he saw it in terms of, intervening seemed to many like it wasn't a big deal, but it was a huge deal. And, containment only seems restrained now because we invaded the darn country.
Right.
So I don't know how to make that into a lesson. It's more like the classic historian thing of being a Cassandra,
Well, I'm sure that someone could glean something could glean something out of the answer. And certainly out of the book too. Well, I think that's a good point to leave it there. So thank you, Joe, for coming again on the show. Really appreciate having you. The book is The Regime Change Consensus: Iraq and American Politics, 1990 to 2003, published just last month, July 2021, with Cambridge University Press. Thanks again, Joe, for coming on. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Grant. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.